welcome to this special extras podcast for subscribers to the Leslie Riddick podcast, and grovelling thanks to you all again for chipping in. Today we're trying to tackle this sort of almost the issue of the moment, a universal basic income. It's extraordinary and good that something that seemed to be a sort of fringe idea in the never-never land has suddenly landed itself really smack bang centre of so many manifesto pledges, at least, during this election campaign. And I was chairing a hustings event at which our two guests were also performing to try to just, you know, demythologize some of this and just get straight how it could work, what the response could be to various criticisms, and whether or not we'll see this in our lifetimes, short of independence, and even then. So, Begorra, here the two of them are again, Mike Danson and Jamie Cook. Hello, chaps.
Hello.
Hi, Leslie.
Now, just to get this, Mike, I've known for a long time, Professor Mike Danson, who has worked in many of these issues and poverty as well, in various universities, latterly at Heriot Watt. And Jamie Cook, who is the head bummer of RSA Scotland. And when I was foolish enough to try to make sure I understood that, it is indeed the Royal Society for what?
For the Encouragement of the Arts, Manufactures and Commerce.
And see, you sound like such a normal guy.
I know, it's very surprising, isn't it?
Right, where are you from, just a matter of interest?
So I'm in Bishop Briggs, just outside Glasgow just now, but kind of moved around a lot growing up. Born in Berlin.
You're born in Berlin?
Born in Berlin and spent my formative years in the Highlands in Dingwall, so, just north of Inverness.
I could hear the twang, you know, just going through the back. Yeah, right. Mike, can you outdo that pedigree?
I'm back in Inverarney, just south of Inverness, about 4 miles away, where my very first memories are from. I'm looking out the window at snow and at a buzzard being chased by some crows.
Oh, right.
And just to make sure, we've actually got the correct Mike Danson here, because where there was a lot, I nearly got in touch with a guy who I think, was it bought or sold the New Statesman, Mike? And no, you got, yeah.
He sold Datastream for 80 million.
Yeah.
15 years ago. That's not me.
So he was very nearly the guy, because he's another Mike Dot Danson here. I thought, wait a minute here.
Are we really sure they're not the same person, to be honest?
This is it. I had to explain to Mike that I'm not the legendary Porrig Joyce that was the All-Ireland full forward and when Galway won the Gaelic football, nor am I the champion bare-knuckle boxer of the Irish traveller community, also called Patrick Joyce. So I'm neither of these people. We now know who each other is, and we'll get on with the serious business.
Just so, the great virtue of having a name like mine is that you're never mistaken for anybody else, and no one can spell it. Anyway, onwards and upwards, chaps. So a universal basic income. Now, people are talking about this as being a great idea. Let's just get, first of all, how would it work? Does anyone want to just give us a run at how it would work if we controlled what we need to control, which seems to be taxation systems and benefit systems?
I could go with that.
Modest men. Right, Mike, go for it.
Yeah, it's an easy one. Okay, so every person in Scotland, regardless of age, would receive a payment periodically, so every fortnight, every month or whatever, unconditionally, so they don't have to be signing on, available for work, in a job, caring, volunteering, whatever, so they would get it as of right, without mean test, and on an individual rather than household basis.
Right. Would this then be replacing universal credit?
It would be replacing many of the existing social security benefits, but not those such as disability, housing and so on, where individual circumstances differ.
So this would, in a sense, first of all, this wouldn't be sort of additional to all the suite of benefits that there are sitting within universal credit. And otherwise, it would essentially be pretty much replacing some of those, but in a different kind of way.
Correct. Yes.
Right. Skivers, you see, the Tories will shout. Mm-hmm. If this is unconditional, then, you know, why would anybody want to work?
I think I always find that really fascinating one, because apart from anything, you want to go back to some of those people who shout Skivers and wonder why it is that they would stop working so quickly if you were to give them money. And of course, they it's never them, it's always someone else. I mean, I think it's really interesting when you look at the current system, universal credit. You couldn't put much more into that in terms of forcing people into work. You know, it's a highly punitive approach. It's got sanctions. You can be punished if you're not looking for work. You can be punished if you don't take work. And it's failing miserably, because actually that's not what people need to motivate and to give them opportunities. A basic income, I think, firstly, you know, and Mike laid out the core aspects of it. It's a basic income. You know, most of the models that we talk about, and I'm sure we'll go into detail maybe on some of those, we're not offering huge sums of money. So people still want to work. They still want to bring in additional income, but it gives them a base that they can work off. It gives them a flexibility and a freedom to choose how they live their life. And actually, when you see wherever similar schemes have been tested out or direct cash payments, you see that people do work. They don't stop working, because actually what we've seen throughout this pandemic is people want to have impact and activity in their life, but they want it to be quality. They want it to benefit them. And unfortunately, far too much of the work that's on offer just now is you know, inhumane and counterproductive. And that's why we have to force people to take it in the first place.
Pat will jump in when he's, you know, yes, feeling there's a gap. Do you feel that yet, Pat?
Yes, yeah, because from my perspective, a couple of things here. Where does the money come from to pay for this, given the fact that as universal basic income, everybody gets it, you know, no matter how much, there are no conditions attached in terms of it's not means tested at all. And maybe this is a purely personal perspective. The amounts of money I've seen paid for, say, example, in places like Finland, where it was £477 a month per person, as you say, per person, no matter what age, isn't exactly earth-shattering for somebody like me, who's a pensioner, getting, yeah, round about £600 a month in possibly the worst pension system in Western Europe. Looking at the Finnish model there, I'd be losing out considerably.
We're really play army. Yeah, I think some interesting points raised there. So I think firstly, in terms of that idea that, you know, where does the money come from? I mean, apart from anything, as we've seen recently, despite previous comments about money, magic money trees not existing, it seems there's an awful lot of them about when you need to, both for positive responses and maybe less useful ones as well. I think the point is that everyone receives a basic income because it recognises that universality of our interaction with society and with each other. And when you look at the universal supports and benefits that have been in place in this country over the last 50, 60 years, they're the ones that retain support from the wider public. As soon as stuff becomes targeted, it's very easy for politicians to jump on it, to cut it and to use it, you know, going back to the Skivers comments, to use it as a target. But also those who are hired earners, I think there's two key points for them. One is, part of the way you pay for this is through income tax. It's not the only way, but it's a part of it. So those who are earning more will also be paying more in tax. They won't be financially benefiting from the basic income itself, but they will still receive it. I think it also recognises that the kind of financial insecurity in society goes far higher up the food chain now than perhaps it used to. You know, we've moved away from that world of a job for life, you know, 9-to-5 work being the best way out of poverty, to actually now where, you know, a significant part of the UK's population can't cope with a financial shock to the system or can see their jobs becoming impacted by new technologies or insecurity. So I think actually it also recognises that there is a greater degree of insecurity there than perhaps has been considered before. And I'm sure Michael have additional thoughts on that, but just in terms of, you mentioned about the levels there, I think two things to point out. One is, I mean, we modelled at the RSA a basic income for Scotland, which is very similar to models that have been put out by other groups in Scotland, which was, yeah, very basic, £4,800 per adult per year. A couple of things with that. One is pensioners, there's then a basic income pension. So at the very least, that would be equivalent to what is in place now, if not more generous. But it takes away the requirement of having paid into the system, which I think makes a big difference and impacts on, you know, the WASP movement and others. The other thing is that even that modest level that we proposed and modelled, the economic modelling at that level showed the elimination of destitution in Scotland entirely, according to the definition of Joseph Rowntree Foundation, and reduction of poverty by about half. So even at quite low levels, because it removes that conditionality and that forcing, that behavioural impacts, you can actually have really significant, society changing impacts at quite low levels of money.
Yeah, the thing I would add to that is that you mentioned about universality. One of the arguments that's been said, I think it was the Global Trade Union Federation, Public Services International said, you know, wouldn't we be better going for universal basic services like free transport, you know, expansion of social housing, public housing, social care, childcare? Wouldn't this be a better way to tackle income inequality? And all their argument they said was that possibly this was kind of a consumerist capitalist perspective. That's why so many Silicon Valley people were in favour of it, because you're actually more money to be spent and in consumerism.
I think Jamie will come in as well, but we don't see a contradiction between universal basic services and universal basic income. So nobody's in favour of basic income is talking about getting rid of the NHS. That's a universal basic service. Or defence, for instance. Those are universal basic services. We all benefit from them in one way or another. I think particularly during the pandemic, people started to reevaluate the whole structure of our society and economy and started to ask questions, which lead us down to in different directions. One would be that the cost of administering quite a few of the services, the benefits that are means tested, the cost of administering is greater than the benefits of them. One of the examples would be prescriptions. They charge for in England. The cost of charging somebody for a prescription is greater than is greater than the actual.
It's costing more to run it than actually is brought in.
Exactly. Yeah, the revenue. So, and there's a number of examples, and James already talked about stigmatisation, putting people off looking for work or looking for better work. As a labour economist, that's one of the main ways in which the current universal credit system is failing. It doesn't encourage people to look for the best job, because economics would say that's what they should be doing. It encourages them to take any job, otherwise they get sanctioned.
Of course, there was a point made in that hustings as well, that there is a danger that if employers know that every worker has got a 500 quid sort of lump sum coming to them, they can just drop wages.
Absolutely. What would happen if they dropped the wages? People wouldn't take the job. They can go to another one who's paying better. You know, that's the market working. But it empowers the precariat, the low paid, to be able to take longer, look around and try and get the job that pays for them best. Norway, as you probably know, Leslie, doesn't have a minimum wage. Rather has good, strong collective bargaining. And that means you don't get poverty wages in Norway. Similarly, under basic income, workers would be far better empowered to look for better paid jobs and not have to take the low paid one that they're offered.
I think as well, I would add into that and say, from my perspective, why wouldn't you have the minimum wage and the living wage alongside that? Because I think you're quite right to identify the challenges. You know, rent's another area. If landlords know that you're going to get an extra 500 quid a month, are they going to charge you an extra 500 quid in your rent? I think it's critical that any of us who are arguing for basic income, it's not as some sort of utopian panacea that solves every problem. Yes. It's a foundation to that new renewed social contract. It's that base that you build upon, and it requires other policies. You know, going back to what you said about universal basic services, it's really frustrated me that it has been set up as an either or, as a competitive idea. I think now we're starting to see it coming together a bit more, which is better. But, you know, as Mike said, universal services are absolutely critical on top of a basic income. But if you don't provide the income itself, if you don't give people that control in their lives, then the services, A, won't have the same impact and effect. But also for me, and this is maybe more of a personal thing, but it plays back to that entrenched paternalism that we have, you know, in Scotland and in many other countries, about we'll provide for you, we'll tell you what you need in your life and what's best for you. And to me, that has been shown as not working over recent years. You need to give people those services that they need to flourish and to grow. And we've seen the pandemic change that conversation massively. Look at the ridicule Jeremy Corbyn got for talking about, universal broadband as a service, and we've now realised it's critical to people's lives. But it has to be, for me, in conjunction and on top of that new foundation of a basic income that gives people security, but also gives them, you know, and we get the pushback in Scotland. People don't like hearing about choice and autonomy because we're still hurt from the Thatcher years. But I think this can be a really positive opportunity. And I think it's been fascinating when you see people like Matt Kerr, who's a councillor in Glasgow, who's been a strong supporter of basic income for several years now. He talks about this as the left's opportunity to reclaim the idea of liberty as a concept of the left, not just as the right, personal liberty. And I think that's a really exciting opportunity to actually empower people in Scotland, to invest in people in Scotland, but not at the expense or as an alternative to services, but as something that enhances and embeds them.
Yeah, I was in a TV debate with Matt, actually, ages ago, Nicky Campbell's programme on Sunday, yeah. And we're sitting right beside him, actually, and just heard this guy, I didn't know Matt at the time, just absolutely waxing lyrical and making, I can even remember his contribution, pointing out that an Aaron Bevan had written a book, or his great report was In Place of Fear. And he said, you know, that was true then, that destitution creates that level of fear. And it's there now, the level of fear that's abroad with all the sanctions and constraints and testing and suspicion and snooping on you and all this kind of atmosphere. Now, I thought, jings, who is this guy? And afterwards, I assumed he might be a Green or, you know, SNP or something. So he's a Labour councillor, you know, all part of his elbow. And I've watched him since then not get the jobs that he's gone for in the Labour Party, because he's stood for various positions. And I've just quietly watched on, thinking if I was to say anything, it probably wouldn't help his chances at all, right? But Labour doesn't choose guys like that. So I wonder, I mean, there's many things to ask you, but just in political terms, how is it that these guys, very enlightened guys, just don't seem to be, you know, how genuine is the commitment within parties at the moment? Or is this mostly lip service?
Was it 4 out of 5 parties are now in favour of, and then the language subtly nuanced, as you suggested, to exploring, examining and so on. But I think there's a real sea change, as Jamie said earlier, that it is now being seriously considered, and not just in Scotland, but in many cities in England, and literally globally. The United Nations Development Programme is signing an agreement with the Global Network on Basic Income this summer to explore the idea of a generally universal basic income that everybody in the world would have, and work towards that. And the poverty elsewhere is obviously much deeper and more persistent, and yet could be addressed fairly readily by raising VAT and such on the biggest economies.
But I mean, conveniently almost, it's really impossible for Scotland to get going on a proper pilot. And I know, Jamie, that you have your doubts anyway about pilots. There was one in Finland that people keep referring back to. We were both at a very interesting event in Tampere in Finland, actually listening to the very moving testimony, actually, of a lot of people who were in that pilot whose lives were transformed, as you say, because they were able to take a HOD of their own lives, basically, and decide if they wanted to be carers and decide if they wanted to study or be artists or set up a new business that might be a bit dodgy and they weren't too sure about it. But at least they had this little banking amount that they could depend on. But so many people refer to the Finland pilot as a failure because it didn't seem to run its course.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's apart from anything, it's a good lesson to us in terms of media management and how you get your messages across, isn't it? The Finnish experiment did exactly what it was set up to do. It ran the course it was meant to run, and it's reported back and been a very successful project. I think what happened was, as it was coming to a close, so it was quite a small targeted, so, you know, a small number of people who were receiving unemployment benefit, had their sanction or their kind of conditional benefit moved over to an unconditional basic income. And what happened was, as it was coming to its close, there was a proposal from the team behind it to expand and continue the project beyond its scheduled end date. And because Finland was about to go into an election, and I think the government who had launched the project, who interestingly were a government of the centre-right, not of the left, they had kind of lost a bit of interest and were distracted elsewhere. But I mean, the study itself was really fascinating. The impact, as you said, on people within it. I did an event recently with the Finnish Cultural Institute, and Tuomas, who was one of the participants in it.
Yeah.
You know, he talked about did he come out of it richer? No. But did he come out of it in a better position? Was his life improved by being part of it? Yes, because he was able to both. He as a journalist was able to take short term gigs that wouldn't have been feasible for him under the previous system, but also the ability to make those choices in his life had benefit. And you know, when you look at the Finnish experiment, what you see come out of it is increased trust in society and in each other. You know, you see improved well-being for the people who took part. And it goes back to, you know, Lizzie, I so strongly agree with what you said about that fear that's been put there. You know, people say to us, it's basic income, it's too radical, you'll never see it happen. We have had radical shifts in the UK and across many Western countries over the last few decades that have never really been put to the electorate to be considered. But that move from, you know, the post-war consensus to the environment we're in now, that, you know, parties across the political spectrum have helped to deliver, which is rooted in lack of trust. We do not trust people. You only get support if you can absolutely prove beyond a doubt that you have to have it, and even then you'll be judged for it. We're perfectly trusting of those at the high end of the income chain. We don't, you know, we're quite happy to trust that they'll pay their taxes on time. But those at the bottom, we do not trust them, and that leads to these negative impacts. And I think, you know, Finland and many others have shown us that huge opportunity that you can have if you start to restore that trust to the basis of the social contract.
But a lot of folk listening might think, do you know, that's great. It sounds a wee bit wafty. You know, that people feel a bit more trust and they feel a bit more like this and that.
Mm-hmm.
I was very impressed at the way that actually the organisers of that hustings really translated this into kind of hard facts. You know, things like at the moment, Willie Rennie is repeating till he's blue in the face, the mental health crisis in Scotland. You know, how universal basic income might well relieve these acute levels of stress that produce this level of mental health. I would love somebody to just say to Willie Rennie, so how about then a universal basic income as a way to resolve this? And just by the by, how do you do a universal basic income unless you control benefits and tax?
Yeah. And I mean, credit to Willie, he's now obviously is a bit more publicly in support of basic income than he was previously. And obviously the Lib Dems down south are also, you know, now have basic income as a policy. I think you're quite right. The challenge he faces is because obviously for his own political views, he'll only consider that within the context of the UK. And it's very difficult to see that progress with the current, you know, UK government. Doesn't mean it's impossible on a UK level. I mean, there were nods towards basic income in the last Labour manifesto, however doomed it was when it went into that election.
Does anyone actually think Keir Starmer is a supporter of basic income?
I don't think Keir Starmer, I think it's unclear just now what Keir Starmer is a supporter of at all. But, you know, the First Minister of Wales is a very strong public supporter.
They're in the same position. I mean, let's just get this one straight, because a lot of people were saying, yeah, let's do a pilot in Scotland. Now, I mean, can we do a pilot in Scotland if we don't have either the buy-in for the DWP, which all concerned have said is just not present, or the powers in Scotland?
No.
For a number of reasons. One is affordability, because as we discussed earlier, we stop other benefits like universal credit. There's also and also we need a relationship cooperation from HMRC. But also if you wanted to move outside Scotland during the period, you would find you'd be sanctioned the minute you move to a different area. DWP said, have you been looking for work for the last so many months? No. So that there are ethical reasons as well as the financial and the affordability. But it's interesting, across England, a lot of the big cities and smaller councils, same in Wales, same in Northern Ireland, are demanding the powers to be able to have a basic income. and therefore the pressure is growing upon DWP, HMRC, Treasury, government to really consider running pilots and experiments in parts of the UK, or at least allowing us to do it ourselves.
Just to come back to it, I mean, what did you both make of the SNP's manifesto commitments? Because they couldn't introduce universal basic income, but examining this ability to bring together benefits and cobble together something that would kind of mirror that. Do you reckon it's worthwhile what the SNP put in their manifesto? Is it achievable and is it worthwhile?
It's in the short term, they're talking about a minimum income guarantee.
Mm-hmm.
Which still would need balanced with and supported with some of the other benefits for disability and housing costs differences and so on. But also it has elements of means testing. So it's a move towards basic income. It would allow us to explore some of the behaviour and attitudinal changes that Jamie touched upon with regard to trust and confidence, which are extremely important in economic terms, as well as personal terms, but it's not a basic income. So it's a step in the right direction in our view.
Right. Yeah, and I would just add to that, because I had a little bit of concern when it was first being mooted, because I think, you know, in some ways it's not a surprise that it was a little bit surprising to see Anas Sarwar expressing some support for basic income, because I didn't think it was naturally his kind of political positioning. But you can see that quite quickly that sort of took on more of that minimum income guarantee, and as Mike said, because it keeps a lot of that kind of conditionality and targeting, it fits a bit more into that kind of paternalistic controlling view that we were talking about earlier. So I was a bit concerned when there was mention from the SNP that this would be a kind of diversion, that this would be the kind of limited approach, and actually, yeah, of course we'd love basic income, but we can't do it, so we're just going to forget about it. I actually think that what has been put forward feels a very sensible start. When I was first involved in this in basic income and spoke to senior folk in the SNP, what you get told at the time was, oh, we like the idea, and maybe one day in an independent Scotland we'll think about it. And you know, you would say to them, well, if you don't have the idea prepped and worked out in detail, you won't be looking at it in an independent Scotland for at least a generation, because you're not suddenly going to make massive changes as you're transitioning. To me, this feels, and I think there's been a significant shift in terms of both rhetoric, but I think some of the actions of the SNP over the last year or so is really starting to do that groundwork, to really put the effort into really looking at what the policy is. And I think, you know, Nicola Sturgeon has said on several occasions now that basic income is ultimately still the goal. This is what can be done in the meantime. It'd be very easy for them to say, we can't do anything, or it'd be very easy for them to take a short path. Now, I think we all have a responsibility to ensure that we keep them to it. But I actually think it's a really promising step. And I think the fact that, you know, after the elections next week, we will almost definitely have that the majority of members of Scottish Parliament will be pro basic income in some shape or form. I think that's a huge, significant step forward from where we were. And I think we do have a really promising space there for making things move forward.
Yep.
And there was, just so people know, I mean, there was a feasibility study done last year. There were four local authorities, Glasgow, Edinburgh, North Ayrshire, Fife, were involved in that. Yeah. It was funded by the Scottish Government to just demonstrate how basic income could decrease poverty, increase well-being. And actually, Glasgow Council have passed a motion calling on both governments to carry out trials in Glasgow. So it is kind of just moving, you know, along a wee bit. And actually, in that hustings that I mentioned, Paul Sweeney, the Scottish Labour candidate, was actually suggesting there was a way to try to whiffle around with a 2016 Act, which could effectively mean that without the DWP getting, you know, giving us a go ahead, the Scottish Government could actually run a pilot here and somehow make the DWP a client. I mean, I didn't quite follow all of that, and we hadn't enough time to dive in. But is there? It was an unusual moment where Paul Sweeney seemed to be suggesting a cuter kind of, you know, let's say, manipulation of the current devolved settlement than the SNP at that moment. But do you think that's a goer?
I've not looked in detail at that, but if it was a goer, I think, as in other areas, we would see it being stopped quite quickly by changes at Westminster. Mm-hmm. It still raises questions about affordability and so forth. I remember Glasgow about 20 years ago asked to have the powers to have a similar sort of approach for those on benefits under a full employment initiative, so they could help people into work, into training and so on, without effectively the sanctions element, and so they could go back onto benefits very easily if whatever they tried didn't work. And DWP, the Treasury, just said absolutely and utterly no. Although we knew that that sort of approach would work, and we've seen experiments at a much lower level, they didn't want to lose control and power. And I would think that even if Paul Sweeney's proposal was feasible, it would soon become unfeasible.
So in that case, I mean, where are we going with this? Do you think immediately after the election, okay, so we're going to have a pro basic income set of MSPs elected, and then, ooh, blast, they all discover they just can't do anything about it?
I think we'll see a couple of things. So I think, you know, you mentioned earlier, I'm not strongly convinced that a large-scale experiment is the best step at this point anyway, even if we could deliver it for all the challenges that Mike's laid out already. Because I think a lot of the data is already out there that we've seen from other experiments of similar styles over the years, and that includes those health impacts that you were talking about, Leslie, you know, where hospital admissions decrease and, you know, there's positives we can see. For me, I think now it's about policy, and it's about the human interactions that come out of this. One of the basic income programs that I've always talked about, and I really love, is one called Humans of Basic Income, which was set up by Jesse Golem in Ontario in Canada. And it just captured the stories of those who were participating in the Ontario Basic Income Experiment, which was very frustratingly cut short due to a change in political administration in Ontario. And capturing those stories, I think, is a really powerful space now to start to move into that real world impact that it can have in people's lives. And I think there's opportunities within that to look at maybe small scale tests where, you know, you're maybe working with 100 people for a year, or you're looking at a specific group just to get those interactions out of it. And they are ways that you can work around much easier the large interactions that, you know, having thousands of people participating brings with DWP and HMRC and the rest. But I also think we are now in a position where, you know, at the end of the day, we're getting support for basic income from both pro-independence and pro-union sides, which I think is very interesting and promising. You know, we can question the deliverability on both sides, but I think it's a very strong possibility we will see basic income ever more now being built into certainly the campaign and the argument for independence for Scotland. And I think that gives a really powerful space where we may not be able to deliver it under the current terms straight away, but if we can do, as I said earlier, that groundwork, have that policy prepared so that it can be taken to people and said, look, this is ready to go and ready to be part of the foundation of an independent Scotland, I think that's a huge and important piece of work that can be taking place, already is taking place, but can really be taking place over the next few years. And which also allows, you know, the pro-union sides, you know, people like Willie, when he's saying, well, we can deliver this with the UK government, well then, answer that question. Here's the work. We can show you what the policy is. You tell us how it gets delivered under a UK settlement.
And could also just pick up on the mental health and the well-being and so on. We ran a whole series of workshops over the winter with those with mental health challenges and illness and so on around basic income. And it's exactly that sort of testing of the water we did there. And with very beneficial and useful and honest results coming out. So as Jamie said, we've had lots of pilots and experiments around the world testing different elements, outcomes, possibilities from having a basic income. And there's, so all that groundwork is there now to be built on with some real introductions of basic income.
And of course, the thing that we maybe haven't said is the obvious thing, that if you're getting a basic income, you actually get it. I mean, the plethora of little grants and kind of eligibilities and things that you have to know about to apply for, and this kind of basket of stuff that comes your way, you have to apply for it at the moment. And there's billions sitting there not claimed, which would stop happening if we had a basic income.
Absolutely. That news this morning that just one school in Glasgow put in a financial advisor for parents and generated £400,000 worth of income. Strathclyde Regional Council, district councils in the past have really promoted welfare rights officers, and it shows that by putting One, there's a lot of unclaimed money, but two, putting that money into a local community, a deprived community, can boost the local economy in much more positive ways than tax cuts for the rich and the better off.
Right. Well, my mind's blowing. This is kind of absolutely fascinating. What we need to see happening. So thank you both very much. I mean, we'll look to see what happens then. And if there is an initiative coming forward, try to kind of focus on that when we get to the other side of the elections. Yeah. But meantime, Pat will also put links. If folk are listening and think, jings, I'm interested in this man. We'll put some links in that you can read further for your own benefit. And thanks very much to both of you.
No, thanks for having us on. And, you know, it's worth highlighting that we've got the World Basic Income Congress in Glasgow this summer, sadly online. But I think, you know, that's going to be a really fascinating space to connect with thinking here in Scotland, but also that global movement. So hopefully as many listeners as possible can join us for that. It's the first time ever the Congress will be completely online and free for people to participate. So it would be great to have as many people join us as possible.
Absolutely. Yeah.